Reenacting the Past. What does it feel like to dress up in a scratchy wool Revolutionary War uniform, camp out for days, and reenact a battle? What about donning a suit of armor and using a bow and arrow as a weapon? Reenactors know the answer. These are people for whom simply reading about history isn't quite enough. They want to understand it by reliving it. I'm Jennifer Rooks. All over Maine, different reenactment organizations are alive and flourishing, staging everything from major military encampments to private, invitation-only parties. Have you ever taken part in a historical reenactment? Are you passionate about a specific period in history? What can we learn about our modern world from the experience of stepping back into the past? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. For many of us, when we hear about reenactors, we think about reenactments of Civil War battles. But reenactors cover many different eras. Today, we're going to learn about the people behind the costumes and the history that inspires them. Joining me in our studio are three longtime reenactors. Miss Christabel Rose has sanded the decks of the USS Missouri, operated the 1863 oven at Fort Knox, and partnered with the Patriot Guard Riders. She has also organized some pretty big events. Tom Backus is from Walderboro and reenacts a variety of historical periods, from the American War for Independence to World War I. And Matt Blazek has more than 25 years' experience as a reenactor, medievalist, and theater performer. His current project is the Agincourt Soldier. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you participated in or seen reenactments in Maine? What questions do you have about how they choose the era they focus on or the people they'll become? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you all for being here. I know this is a very busy season for reenactors. I want to know from each of you how you got into this. How did you get into reenacting history? Miss Rose, I'll start with you.
I grew up with history all of my life. I originally started in the Mystic Seaport with the Whaling Museum when I was just a child. And when I moved to Hawaii, I got into World War II quite a bit, obviously, with Pearl Harbor. And once I came here to Maine, I learned about the Civil War reenactors in Fort Knox, and everything has just gone from there.
So you were a kid in Mystic, Connecticut. Were you dressing up even then?
I wasn't dressing up at the time, but I was helping my grandfather at the time was the groundskeeper, setting the cobblestone streets and things, and it just, the history took to me.
All right. Your turn, Tom. How'd you get into it?
I really didn't have a choice in the matter. My father did it when he was 15, I think he started. So as soon as me and my brother were old enough to go to these events, we got dressed up and hauled into it. And for us, it just that seemed like that's what everyone did. You know, you get back from school vacation. Kids are talking about Disney and we're like, yeah, we went to Gettysburg, and no one really kind of understood that.
So, but Tom, when you were a kid, did you go kicking and screaming or were you excited about
it? No, I didn't know any better. I just assumed that's what everyone did, and it wasn't until, later on in school, it was like, oh, wait, this isn't normal. What do you mean?
Wait, did you say my brother's and me?
My brother, yeah.
Yeah, your brother. Does he still do reenactments?
No, he joined the real army and, that was enough to, take that out of him,
Okay, Matt, what about you?
I've always been sort of fascinated by, the knights in shining armor and things like that. So and doing theater growing up, things like Shakespeare. And I came to find out reading that the real stuff was just as exciting as the fantasy. So I really got into the real history behind the legends and found out that it could be just as fascinating as the other stuff.
Okay. And so I want to say to our audience, because this is radio and the audience can't see you all three of you are younger than I am. If you have a stereotype of reenactors as being a bunch of old guys, you're wrong. And tell me, what makes a good reenactor? What makes somebody who you would want to have join one of your events, Ms. Rose?
A love of history, for starters. I mean, and respect for what we're trying to represent. There's different, they call it a hobby, and some of us kind of take exception to that because it's really a lot of work in living histories and it's expensive. But we do it for the love of it. I personally do it because I want to honor those who came before me and make sure that they're remembered going into the future. But you have fun while you're doing it. You interact with the folks. Getting it to the children is the biggest thing that we try to do. And they learn a lot more from the hands-on interaction they can have with us than they could ever learn from a book. So we try and focus on them whenever possible.
Okay. What do you think, Matt?
And a willingness to learn and to realize that
exactly
history isn't static. You know, we know what we know now, but with further research, that could change. And that willingness to accept what has changed and move forward with it. So
Tom, I know that you have several eras, but I want to find out from all of you all how you kind of picked your era. We heard a little bit, Miss Rose, you said that you have, you know, experience with World War II and Hawaii, but how did you sort of settle on becoming a Civil War expert?
I'm not an expert by any means, but that happened to be at the time where I fell in with the group. There was a small group in northern Maine, and it just took to me. I had already known about widows and the mourning processes through the Victorian era, and that was where I originally started from. But I wanted to see more for the state of Maine, and so that's why we've taken it to the Maine Living History Association to offer other things as well to enrich and bring Maine's history to life, because a lot of folks don't realize just how much history there is here in the state.
Tom, do you have a favorite era? And if so, why?
It's hard.
Difficult.
We have so many. Probably, personally, World War I. For a number of different reasons, from an ancestral standpoint, everyone that was of age during the war served during the war, whether it was nurse, YMCA, or soldier. I have an ancestor who died over there. And, you know, so from a personal level, that's, you know, that's a big thing for my family. But the other thing from an educational standpoint, not a lot of people really think about it. I mean, when you think of the World War, what do you think about? You think about World War II. The sequel had a better production level than the first one. And it's because America was only in it for a little over a year. But in that year, I mean, so much changed for the country, going from basically an isolationist nation to, for better or worse, modern America, you know, on the world stage.
Matt, tell me about the Agincourt soldier and tell me if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
You're not, but I wasn't going to say anything.
Correct me. That's fine.
It's Agincourt.
Agincourt,
so
okay.
So the Battle of Agincourt happened in the 1415. It was during a time where there was so many things happening in Europe, so many changes of military technology, of social classes, of everything, technology in itself. So I came at this from the theater aspect side of it. You know, Shakespeare's Henry V was one of the best plays he's ever written. People tended to put some of the other ones above at first, but I like Henry V best. But during this time, it was done not just to go win a battle and not just to think, you know, the history says that Henry V went to France to try to reclaim the French crown for the English kings. But there was so much other stuff going on. I mean, France was in a civil war. England was actually on the verge of civil war. There was the sort of underpinnings of what would become the Protestant Reformation, in about 100 years. So there was just so much stuff. It's really the last era where you see what's classically known as the knight in shining armor, because they're starting to introduce guns into European warfare. You're starting to see the mobilization of what's known as what we would call the infantry and the creation of that. So it's just so much thing was going on and changing that there's so much you can pick from.
So you've created sort of an interactive presentation around this. You become the Agincourt soldier?
I have. So what I do is I go to schools or libraries, other civic organizations, scout troops, anyone that will have me really want to listen to me talk. And I can set up different ways. Generally what I do is I bring all my gear. The kids sort of play squire, help me dress up into the armor, getting out of the armor while I talk about it. I give them some talking points about history. And then I usually do some weapons demonstrations. And I'll tell you, students love watching a watermelon get hit with a 6-foot pole hammer. does it sort of explode. Medieval Gallagher is what we joke about. The hit it with the watermelon, it just sort of...
It's that kind of thing's been popular for a long time. And we'll just make a note that our intern, Ella Boyd, tried on. What would you call the equipment she tried on?
She tried on my helmet. It's a Hounskull Bassinet helmet, basically. The Bassinet was one of the most used helmet styles for probably close to 200 years.
Okay, we've posted that on our Facebook page. Miss Rose, I know you've organized some really, really, really big events, but I want you to talk about what happened in 2010 at Fort Knox. That was your doing. How did you conceive of that, and what happened?
Well, we were there normally with the 20th Maine doing a School of the Soldier operation, and I decided that we needed to augment that to try and bring some more focus to the fort. And I had a number of reenacting friends that lived out of state, and this would be a wonderful thing to do. The problem is, where it's so remote, there would be no way to feed them, and normally I would cook and feed the reenactors. So the state graciously allowed me to get the oven operational, which was amazing, and just invited everybody that I knew. We had 238 reenactors, came from all over the country in Canada. And ideally, hopefully, maybe they'd be open to doing a 10th anniversary next year for Maine's bicentennial.
Mm. 238 reenactors. I understand something like 1,500 people watched.
On one day, we had that. It was over 3,000 total for the weekend that we had come in and out of the fort.
And this was not just people sitting around. You had, but this was by land and by water, right?
Yes. We had a couple of ships that came through and fired upon the fort, and the troops mustered to go and keep them at bay, so to speak.
Yep. Wonderful. What's your favorite event that you've been part of, Tom? Or if you can't pick a favorite, just tell me about one that was really exciting to you.
Well, obviously the bigger Civil War events like Gettysburg, because all of a sudden you have 20,000 of your best friends all on the field, and it gives you an actual feel of what it was like to see that kind of numbers. So definitely that, for an immersive experience, probably the Newville Tacticals in Pennsylvania for World War I, because basically you go into the trench Friday afternoon and you don't come out until 11 p.m. on Saturday. So you're kind of just thrown in there, and it rains, and it's awful conditions, and you're miserable, and it's fantastic.
Well, this is what I wanted to ask all of you. I want to hear about some aha moments that you had, that you kind of did, even though you've studied your history, even though you kind of knew what you were getting to, you used the word immersive experience, still given that when you were there, you thought, oh, I get it now. Go ahead, Matt.
Let's see. One of the things that I've really learn, you know, you read about how some of the soldiers, when they're on campaign, literally wore the bottoms out of their shoes, and we don't think of that happening. It's like, for us with a modern shoe, we'd have to walk thousands of miles. But I've been doing a lot of hiking in gear throughout Maine now, and I've literally worn the bottoms out of my shoes, and it's interesting to be walking and all of a sudden be like, oh, so this is what it felt like. Okay, maybe I'm a little too crazy to be doing this.
So you're in full armor and you're walking in shoes that have suddenly just kind of disintegrated,
yeah, exactly,
under your feet.
And you're like, oh, so this is what the historians wrote about, because it was something that was most historians up to a certain point weren't writing about the mundane of the everyday happenings. They would only write about things that would catch people's attention. So one of those, you know, aha moments like that would be, you know, they wrote about their shoes, you know, dissolving around their feet, and you walk enough and all of a sudden it does that and you're like, oh, okay, so this is why it was, you know, fascinating to them. Or another one is I've foolishly let friends shoot at me with a bow and arrow while in armor, and I've had it hit me and ricochet off, and it is that feeling to be like, you know, I really am, you know, we were, these guys really were the tanks of the medieval times, you know. You have that moment of like, yeah, I let's go run in traffic, and your wife's going, no, don't do
well,
that.
Well, I'm saying, Matt, I understand that you're a father now, so I'm hoping you're not letting your friend shoot at you anymore. Okay, fine. Miss Rose, did you have any aha moments you want to share with us?
The first one I'd have to say was going back to Fort Knox. So I'm between the oven, and then as a female and as a woman, there weren't very many soldiers during the Civil War, so we don't get to experience or even come close to realizing like what Tom just said about going to Gettysburg. But once all of the troops were in, because we had them garrisoned inside the fort, about 2:30 or so in the morning, I took a walk up through the officers' quarters. And when you went through there, everybody was sleeping with their muskets either next to them or propped up against the wall. Candles were flickering, and they were all breathing in unison. And it was just such an amazing moment to see all of these soldiers in this, garrisoned in this fort that never actually had soldiers in it. And if they had actually been there, that was kind of a, yeah, I'm in the right place at the right time moment.
Mm. Okay, your turn, Tom.
Probably last, yeah, it was last year. We did a World War I event in Newville, Pennsylvania, and it was like 10:30. We had like a half hour to go, and the temperature dropped to like 38 degrees, and it's downpouring. And I'm walking through the trench, and everyone just looks miserable. And it's like, this is, you know, because there's nothing modern. It's in the middle of this field, it's about 100 and something acres, surrounded by trees. So there's nothing modern. We've, you know, just been running around all day, and everyone's just exhausted. And at that moment of realizing, you know, you're stuck there. There's nothing. The trench is filling up with water. And you had that real moment of just, that's what it looked like. And, you know, it was a very, you know, somber moment to just see everybody like that up until someone said, hey, I'm having a great time. And it's like, oh, okay, thanks for ruining my moment.
That's what I was going to say. Even though it seemed like that, nobody had dysentery.
Oh, no. And that's the thing. For most reenactors, you put yourself in these miserable conditions, and someone on the outside looks at it and they're like, oh, those poor people. You know, meanwhile, the reenactor's saying, this is great, you know. Yeah, the saying for American Revolution reenacting is, if you're having a good time, you're not doing it right.
Oh, my goodness. Well, I understand there's an event just tomorrow in Minot. And Miss Rose, tell us about it. You were involved in planning that.
Well, this is the Historical Society there is putting on a Civil War encampment. It's the third year that they've done it where they've had a number of troops there. The 3rd Maine Company A will be present, the 15th Alabama, the Confederate group here in Maine will be there, and the 5th Connecticut. And this has been a fundraiser for them. They've been doing, and they've just started to expand on the number of reenactors that are there. So they will be there all day Saturday and I believe Sunday morning. I don't have the actual times. And they'll have a lot of activities. They have a lot of children's activities as well. They'll be doing some demonstrating, some drilling, and maybe a little skirmishing for folks to watch.
So if you want to watch, you've never been to one of these, you just show up? I mean, is there anything mm-hmm. you need to know?
No, you just you can go on their website or on their Facebook. They have all of the times and things there for when they're doing the demonstrations. Each one is different. Sometimes there's a fee to get in to see the events, and sometimes it's just you walk in and they just point you in the right direction, and you just go at it and have a good time.
Well, we're talking about historical reenactors on Maine Calling. If you'd like to call in and talk about your own experiences or ask them any question, 1-800-399-3566. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Lake Stewards of Maine, protecting Maine lakes through widespread citizen participation. Learn how you can help at lakestewardsofmaine.org. Tandem Coffee, celebrating conversation, coffee, cheddar biscuits, and no Wi-Fi. In Portland and at tandemcoffee.com. And Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine.
Maine State Music Theater has existed here in the Brunswick area for 60 years.
We do a mix of different kinds of musicals. We do some old chestnuts. We do some newly released pieces.
Maine State Music Theater to me is just a gem of a theater that people from Maine and all over the country enjoy in the summertime.
Our audience and Maine Public's audience align together. They care about their community. They care about quality. and they care about the arts in Maine.
Maine Public caters to a thinking audience, and the thinking audience are the people that want to come and enjoy what we have to offer.
Being the audience services manager, the first thing we do is ask people where they've heard about us when they buy tickets. An amazing amount of time people tell me from Maine Public, and that makes me know we're doing the right thing.
Have you ever wanted to manage a database that is at the very heart of what helps make your favorite Maine Public radio and television programs possible? Maine Public is seeking a full-time database administrator to join our advancement team to oversee Maine Public's philanthropic relationship management system. If you or someone you know have the skills to take this on and a passion for Maine Public media, please visit mainepublic.org and click on About and then Careers. Thanks.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, learning about the world of reenactors. Joining me are three reenactors of different eras. Matt Blazek specializes in medieval history. Tom Backus reenacts different periods from the American War for Independence to World War I. And Miss Christabel Rose is a Civil War reenactor. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post to our Facebook page. On the line with us now is Monique Bouchard. She is an Old Town Maine native who has been involved with historical reenactment since she was a teenager. Monique, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me along.
Tell us about how you got involved in historical reenactments.
Sure. I was a flamboyant only child with a penchant for all kinds of things, and of Green Gables and earlier. And so my parents sent me to King's Landing in New Brunswick, which has a two-week reenactment summer camp for children.
Oh, my goodness.
Where you dress up in the garb of the 1800s and in some cases early 1900s, depending on the family with whom you're sort of placed for your 2 weeks. You attend school for half a day every day in the little schoolhouse, and you do all of the chores in all of the clothing of the period. Your electronics and your makeup and your hair dryers are all taken away from you at the beginning of the week. And there you are. You learn to cook with lard, and you learn to milk a cow. And it was absolutely some of the best 2 week periods of my entire life.
So you were hooked, and the rest part of the pun is history. I understand you're now involved in the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism. What is that? And tell me about the different kingdoms in the larger kingdom of Maine, or is it not called Maine?
Yeah, we'll get there. It works for right now. So the Society for Creative Anachronism is an international nonprofit that is devoted to the education and the reconstruction of medieval and pre-medieval history. So anything from around 1600 through the past to Romans and Egyptians and anything else, we have a pretty broad net for what people tend to study. Most folks find a particular era that they fall in love with, and then that becomes kind of their thing. But it's an international organization with over 30,000 members who are sort of dues-paying members. In the state of Maine, we have 300 or so of those folks. And we live in one of the 20 kingdoms of the Society for Creative Anachronism, the known world. And our kingdom is the East. It runs through the eastern Canadian provinces from Quebec East and then down to Pennsylvania, Delaware, parts of New York, up along the eastern seaboard. Maine is lucky to have several groups. The place that you are right now in southern Maine would be the province of Maligentia. I am up near Bangor, and our area is the Barony of Endoard. Matt Blazek, who I know very well from this organization too, is in the Shire of Hadchester on the Midcoast. And we have a group in Lewiston, Auburn, the riding of Ravensbridge, and way up north in Aroostook County, we have the Shire of Smithwick. So we have all of our beautiful fantasy little towns and shires and baronies and provinces right here in the state of Maine.
Okay, so Monique, before I let you go, tell me if you have a favorite story to tell about your time as a reenactor. How come Matt just said, oh no?
What did he just do?
He said, oh no.
Oh no. Oh my goodness, Matthew. So Matt and I have been friends. We have camp in a similar household of 14th century reenactors, although I have slid toward the Viking era around 1100 is the clothing that I currently portray in the SDA. I think some of the most impactful moments as a reenactor and a recreationist for the SDA is that we never know the outcome of a particular battle. We are trying new things all of the time. So for me, it's a lot about finding a bunch of recipes that are kind of obscure, cooking them over fire with good friends, tasting the results. Sometimes they're a little iffy. Sometimes they're absolutely magnificent. And you spend this time with people of like mind laughing about what these modern pop songs would have been sung if they had been in Middle English, or what would have happened if you had actually been at the Battle of Hastings? What would the food have been? What would the drink have been? What indeed would those experiences have been, as Matt talked about earlier, in wearing your shoes absolutely off your feet? And so I think that experience part for me is the big lore for many people of the SCA.
Well, Monique, thank you so much for joining us today. That's Monique Bouchard, a longtime reenactor from Old Town, Maine. Moving on to Portsmouth, New Hampshire, we have Mark. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Mark Bernier, or Marcus Boyer, as people who've seen my show know me. So I had a couple questions. I started reenacting about 25 years ago, and I've since recently retired. I don't heal up like I used to. And I run the New Hampshire Renaissance Fair, and I've been active in the SCA, and I've done reenactment, and I've done living history. And I wanted your guests maybe to talk to people who wouldn't know the difference if they're going to try an SCA event or go to a reenactment event or a living history event, any one of those, what people might experience when they see them and what the differences would be.
Yeah, go ahead, Ms. Sure. Rose. Yeah.
Well, obviously, with the different eras, you have the SCA, which, as we say, some of that is interpretive, and we have fun with that to see where it can go with that. With the Civil War era, however, we pretty much know what happened, and we have scripts sort of to follow, but we can't use presentism to go with what Matt was saying earlier with regard to the willingness to learn. Presentism has no place in reenacting, but the reenactments versus living histories.
I want to interrupt you. Tell me what presentism is.
Well, it's like when you're trying to take modern terms and relate them to what happened in the past. We've evolved so much since then. Something that may have been acceptable back in the 1800s certainly is not acceptable in modern terms. But when you look at what we do in the 1800s to present the history, you can't look at it through modern eyes. You have to look at it through the times. You know, slavery is a perfect example. When we talk about slavery and we use terms that were being used during the 1800s, we don't do that anymore. We've learned since then and we've evolved. And we need to understand when we go back and look at those things that it's not modern terms and presentism, but it was of the time. And then we can go forward. With regard to the living histories and the reenactments, generally a reenactment would be you're recreating something that you either already know that it's happened and you have the numbers to do that. New Orleans is a perfect example of reenactments that can take place here in the state of Maine, where you have 50 or 60 reenactors, some Confederates, some Union, and they can actually recreate a battle. You had Fort Knox, as we talked about earlier. That would have been a reenactment because you had numbers en masse to give a good representation. Here in the state of Maine, it's more of a living history circumstance where you would go to something and you would experience it through the reenactors, more personal one-on-one types of things. So you have, you know, reenactments is Gettysburg, where you go down there and they reenact the battles. Here in Maine, we do more living histories, at least through our eras, where you can go and you can interact with the folks and you can learn from that. And folks often get confused between the two and they go, oh, we're going to a reenactment and they're expecting Gettysburg. And then there's five soldiers, mustering in. So they need to understand there is a difference.
Okay.
A good sort of illustration of what living history would be is like the Jamestown Museum in Virginia, where they're not reenacting any one thing that happened then, but they're showing a general, this is what daily life was for these people at the Jamestown colony of the time. So you might get some reenactments happening within a living history sense where you have enough people to actually do a reenactment of something, but not you don't necessarily have to have the reenactment to do living history.
Okay. Mark, thanks for your question. We'll go to Patrick, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Patrick. Go ahead.
Hi, how's it going? My name is Patrick Vigue. I'm calling in today in regards to any pushback about these reenactments. You know, I'm all for it, and I think it's a great thing. However, you know, do you ever receive any pushback saying, you know, we shouldn't do this, or, you know, this should be laid to rest pretty much rather than reenacting it, especially for more modern day type reenactments where veterans may still be alive? That's pretty much it.
Yeah, I know most of you do eras where people are not still alive, but Tom, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be people who look at anything you do and say, well, I don't think you should be doing that. And even I know people who do World War II where there are people who say aren't you worried about offending them? And that is a real fear for a lot of people during that time period. At the same time, I know a lot of those reenactors that have actually spoken to those people that they portray. And those veterans are actually incredibly happy about that. That's something I always wondered, you know, doing any time period, how would those people view what I'm doing? And, you know, it's always been one of those things. Am I doing them a dishonor? You know, we obviously try our best, but we're not getting it accurate. You know, I've never had Spanish influenza. I don't think you've ever had the Black Plague, you know,
That one time.
So, like I said, with World War II, being able to talk to them and have them be like, no, we really appreciate what you're doing. You're keeping it alive. You're not going to please everybody. There's always going to be somebody who doesn't like what you're doing. But if you're honoring those who served or, you know, those of those time period and you feel you're doing an accurate job with it, then, you know.
I think it's important to remember that we approach this as from a basis of respect. That's our starting point, respect. We are fascinated by these people that came before us, and we understand that they were people, and we want to understand what their lives were like and how they shaped them. So when we do that, we're not just dressing up in costumes. I refer to what I wear as costume. It's clothes. It is clothing to be worn and used as clothing. It's not a Halloween costume that I just put on and you know, run around in the woods in. We want to know and experience what their lives were like because we respect those who came before us. And it's important to teach people history from a starting point of respect instead of just a read this in a book, because you don't get the full picture from just reading it in the book. I mean, you can read what the knight wore in a book, but until you've actually put it on and worn it and, you know, spent hours in this stuff, you don't know what it was like and how this stuff changed their lives. I mean, there's grave finds we found where men who were archers from the late 15th century, they were pulling bows so powerful that it changed the physiology of their bodies. It made their arms thicker and their collarbones thicker. So we want to show that these people weren't just writings in a book, but they were real three-dimensional people.
I agree with everything that these guys have just said. We start with respect for the era that we're portraying. And as going back to the presentism, more and more information is available. I just started doing this 10 years ago, and there was not a lot of research available for what a woman did besides just be a washerwoman or part of the Maine Camp Hospital Association. And I knew there had to be more with the civilian aspect of it. So as we're learning more over the past 10 years, we now have a better presentation. Our clothing is now more spot on accurate. Our recipes, those things we're able to do. And so that we can present just what life was back then so that it can go forward and we can learn from that.
So I'm guessing for you, finding something like a diary or letters is just treasure.
It's a treasure. It's phenomenal. And that's where a lot of the current information with regard to the Civil War is coming from, versus books that were written by the victors, so to speak. Now these diaries are coming out. My great-great-granddad's came out, my great-great-grandmother's diary, I have that. And so we're now able to actually read their actual words of what happened. And we have a battle scene where you read it in a book that it went one way, but now you have four different soldiers, and they all kept diaries back then. And they're all now, all four of them, describing in a different way. Now we know more facts on what actually happened versus just what was written by the victors. So we're bringing those new facts to light so that people can learn what actually did happen.
Patrick from Brunswick, thanks so much for calling. Great question. If you have a question, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We're talking with historical reenactors, and we'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Holocaust and Human Rights Center of Maine, inviting you to learn about Maine's Holocaust survivors at the Michael Klar Center in Augusta, hhrcmaine.org. The Maine Art Museum Trail, 9 museums, 80,000 works of art, 350 scenic miles, infinite possibilities, maineartmuseums.org. And Ocean View at Falmouth, announcing Cumberland Crossing, its new sister retirement community in Cumberland, cumberlandcrossingrc.com.
40 years. Down Memory Lane has been doing its thing for 40 years. Hi, this is Toby LaBoudelier. Our home these days on Friday afternoons is over on the Maine Public Classical Channel on real FM airwaves, not on one of those special secret internet digitized side channel outlet hard to find things. And with Maine Public Classical now on 7 beautiful FM stations around the state, including the newest 102.3 FM in many areas of York County, maybe you could make Down Memory Lane your thing on Friday afternoons. From 2 to 5 every Friday afternoon, hope to see you there.
Immigration officials have traditionally honored state pardons when considering who to deport, but that's stopped in one state.
When you change course so dramatically and you're a federal agency like the Board of Immigration Appeals, you have to explain yourself.
On Next from the New England News Collaborative, legal challenges to the detention of immigrants. And we'll go looking for the oldest trees.
I think most of the places that are old forest, we may not even know about.
Please join us.
That's coming up today at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on program, Reenacting History. My guests are Tom Backus, who is from Walderboro and covers all aspects from the American War for Independence to World War I. Matt Blazek is a longtime reenactor, medievalist, and theater performer. And Miss Christabel Rose has lived in history since she was a little girl. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Dave, who's calling from Waterboro. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. Thank you very much for taking my call. My name's Dave Bean, and Jen, you and I worked together a long time ago.
Oh, hi, Dave.
Hey, how you doing?
I was thinking about you the other day. Nice to hear your voice.
It's good to hear yours. Hey, listen, I'm a historical nut from, Civil War, any type period of warfare, but I've always thought about getting involved, with the 20th Maine or some group. That's only because that's what I'm familiar with. But how do you get started and how expensive is it? Because I've heard it's pretty expensive and I'm not sure exactly how do you get started? What do you do? Who do you call?
Oh, my goodness. All three of our guests kind of rolled their eyes with that. Oh, gosh, do I have to? Yeah. Do I have to fess up here?
Sorry. I'm sorry, guys.
Hey, Dave. That's a really good question because folks say, we'd really like to do this, but how do we do it? You can certainly do a web search for it. Here in the state of Maine, you mentioned Civil War specifically. You do have the 20th Maine, which is in northern Maine. They have a number of their members are pretty much in a roostic at this point, but they do come down as far as Bangor. You have the third Maine, which would be in your area. They're a wonderful group. They do have a website. You could go ahead and look them up. Or if you wanted to go Confederate, you have the 15th Alabama, and there used to be a handful smattering of 3rd Arkansas.
Oh, we still exist.
Okay,
we're still
I wasn't
around.
Sure. I haven't seen you in a while. You need to show up for these
we're
things.
We're still around.
And so you can do that. Or actually, one of the things that we do with the Maine Living History Association is we try to network folks out. So they get a hold of us and say, this is what we're looking for, or historical societies are looking for a uniform or a soldier or something. So if you dash us a quick email, we can go ahead and see if we can hook you up with whatever it is you're looking for. We'll do our best. But I'm going to let Tom tell you about the expense of being a soldier, because that's not where I'm involved.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Hang
guys.
On just a second. Oh. Tom's going to let you know.
So as far as the price tag, how much you got? basically, I mean, depending on which time period you decide to do, it's because like American Revolution, it's a new uniform every year of the war. And of course, there's no sewing machine, so it's all hand stitched. You can, you know, get a decent kit, like for Civil War, you can get a decent kit, you know, for all said and done under $1,000. And then you need the rifle, obviously, which, I mean, you can find them used for $500-$600, but usually they're $800-$1,100, depending on which one you go with. So if you set aside a nice, you know, $2,000, if you squirrel that around, you can get a real, you know, you can get a good kit going, and, you know, that will, you know, take you until you decide to do another hobby or another time period, and then, you know, a couple more.
Okay, so knight in shining armor.
That's a little more than $2,000.
yeah.
So when all things said and done.
You sure you want to say this? Your wife's probably listening.
My wife is listening. I didn't drop all the money at the same time. I think, and some things were gifted to me. But if I had to replace everything brand new, I probably would have to spend, to replace what I have, $6,000 to $7,000. And that's for everything. And that doesn't get into like tents and things like that. That's just the armor and clothes. That's for a high class man at arms portrayal. So you can certainly start cheaper if you want to go lower on the social status for the medieval reenactment.
Peasants
definitely, you know, tunic, shirt, braised tunic. I mean, you don't even need the chausses, the pants to wear. You could just, you know, go barefoot if you had to. But I will say a lot of things are just find a group, go to them, talk to them, see what they require, because a lot of these different groups have different requirements for starting and different levels of what they want you to start at. And a lot of groups actually have loaner stuff that you can wear to try it out before you invest all of this money or time into making stuff for yourself. So get out there, meet up with some people, talk to them, borrow some loaner gear and try it out. So that's what I say.
All right. Well, Dave, I can just see you there. Thanks so much for calling in. We have an email from Nason. Great show. Please talk about Civil War military bands. Any in Maine?
Actually, the 3rd Maine has a band that's attached to it. And they, last I knew, they were still going and doing shows around and competitions. So if you reach out to the 3rd Maine, they can certainly put you in touch with somebody there that can help you out.
Great. An email from Helen. I'm just curious. Why do so many reenactments focus on wars as opposed to regular life? The tensions in and between various groups as part of life seem so fascinating, and how these tensions actually led to violent wars.
Well, I think that goes to the living history versus reenactment discussion we were having earlier, that the living history tends to be more about the daily, you know, the recreating the daily life, while the reenactments, there are places that do. I know of a group, not in the United States, but they've recreated like judicial hearings from the 14th century. So there are places you can reenact things. Reenactments are also sort of the big eye catchers. So if you can get the people to show up, they look really cool.
Well, that and the history of it all as well was around battles. I mean, when we think of eras, we think of eras of the American Revolutionary War, the Civil War, you know, World War I, World War II, and that's how our society pretty much had been created. As far as the civilian aspect of it goes, the Civil War era aspects is starting to go more towards that, because one of the experiences that I had was folks here in Maine want to see what was happening here at home versus what was happening away, because you can see the soldiers anywhere you go. But they wanted to know what was going on here, and a lot of them don't realize, you know, the men all went off to war. Who was taking care of the farms? Who was taking care of all of the work and the cows and the potato fields and things? And that was the women and the children that took care of those things. So they want to see more of that aspect as well.
And there's a group in Maine called the Maine Ancient Ones. They do more.
The Ancient Ones.
The Ancient Ones. They do more of the, are they French and Indian?
Yeah,
they're French and Indian War, but they're more of the sort of daily life. They're not reenacting battles during the French and Indian War. They're just sort of the daily life.
The trappers.
We have places like Fort Western and
Fort Western. Leonard's Mills does a good representation up there as well. They do a couple roundups, they call them, during the course of the year.
And the Maine State Museum has some great exhibits going on about Maine history and you know, just look at to get a good feel and start at things too. So
we have an email from Lucy. Do the guests have any information regarding the demographics of reenactors? I'm wondering about forms of generational power and who gets to play who in these reenactments.
It's actually up until about 10, maybe 15 years ago. Yeah, it was an older demographic. But there's actually a lot of young people getting into it now. Surprisingly, you wouldn't think that. But I mean, I'm 34, and in the group I belong to, I'm the old man. And, you know, it's awful. You know, kids can run much faster than me. But
it depends on what you're reenacting, too. Exactly. It's like, like Monique was speaking, the SCA. The SCA is a great Society for Creative Anachronism. That's a great family orientated, you know, there's lots of stuff for kids to do, youth to do. They have youth combat, youth archery, all arts and crafts for kids. And they really bring, it's a thing that you can bring the whole family to and get them into this stuff. So the demographics of anything in the United States now, it depends on where you are, what you're doing.
Sure. I have a Facebook comment from Aaron. My daughter at Leonard's Mills, a.k.a. the Maine Forest and Logging Museum in Bradley, Maine, she has been able to participate in their annual encampment that happens the first weekend of October every year. She has been lucky to attend with family friends who reenact through Maine and Maritime Canada. It has been an excellent experience for her. It's a great weekend that's open to the public, and this Aaron posted a photo on Facebook, and so this might be an example of everyday life as opposed to a war.
That's what I mentioned earlier about Leonard's Mills. Yes, they do a couple. The roundup was what I called it, because that's what we refer to it as.
Okay, great. We'll go to Mike calling from Bangor. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a dual national, and in 1980, we visited King's Landing, and since it was mentioned, I just had to call. And we were hooked instantly. Our daughter was 5, our son was 3, and we spent the next 26 years volunteering at least one weekend a month, and very often more than that, at King's Landing as citizens of the village doing historic reenactment. It was really a great way to steep our children in their Canadian heritage. We had to do some vocabulary alteration. What's known to the American as the American Revolution on this side of the border is the War of Rebellion on the other side of the border. Our children have since grown up in 2 countries in 3 centuries. We've also reenacted the 18th century at Leonard's Mills and occasionally the 17th century at Fort George in Castine. And it's a great way to get children and young adults involved and interested in history, to have them appreciate from whence they come.
That's great. Thank you for bringing them. That's what we like to hear.
Mike, thanks so much for your call. We're running short on time, but I wanted to just sort of emphasize and ask you all about the level of seriousness with which you take this. This is not something you just do for fun, right?
Yes and no. We have fun. We have a good time with it. One of the things that I started to recognize very early on was people call this a hobby, what we do is a hobby. And I picture hobby, I liken it to golf. You go out and you hit a ball around for 18 holes and then meet at the 19th hole for a beer. We have some responsibility that comes with our hobby, because these folks are looking to us for answers or for their children to have the experience so that they understand what history was like going forward. So we have to be ever mindful that we keep those things first and foremost, to go along with the respect that we're not just putting our own personal presentism opinion into things, that we do recognize, for example, you asked with the Civil War, there were opinions on both sides of that. Some of them were right. Some of them were incorrect. When I do this, I don't support either of the opinions of it. I support the people that were involved and the families and the effect that the war had on society.
All right. Well, that's going to be the last word. Thank you all so much for joining us on this beautiful Friday. That was Miss Christabel Rose. Also here, Tom Backus and Matt Blazek, all reenactors from Maine. Visit our website or Facebook page to see more information about everything we've talked about here on the program. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Ella Boyd answered your calls. You can also see Ella on Facebook trying on a medieval helmet. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.